It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Have you ever set your keys down and moments later forgotten where they were? Have you ever remembered an event in your life and found out that someone else who was there remembered it completely differently? Those are just two quirks in our complicated system of human memory. Our next guest is a memory researcher. In his new book, he shares the latest research about the science of memory and how we might harness that knowledge to improve our lives and understand ourselves a little better. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think of your memory as being particularly good or bad? What sorts of things do you find it easy to remember or harder to remember? Have you found little secrets, tips to help you remember something? Say, attach that name to a face. You could help me out with that. Do you have a question about how memory does and doesn't work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Charan Ranganath is a professor of psychology and director of the Center for Neuroscience at the University of California at Davis. He's the author of the new book, Why We Remember, Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters. Charan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, I don't want to spoil the end of the book, but the answer to the question of why we remember, why humans have the capacity for memory in the first place, isn't completely clear. Why is that such an open question still?
Well, you know, there's the big answer to the question, which is I believe that memory is about understanding what's happening now and being able to anticipate what could happen in the future. But that's kind of an assumption. And in general with science, I find that you really – the whole process is about getting data and then asking better and better questions. So to some extent, why we remember is a big question, but then to really answer it well, you want to go into the smaller, more specific questions as well.
We sometimes think of our memory as, I don't know, like a camera. We've stored all this data and we just dig into those files and access it. That's completely wrong in a lot of ways. You say in your book that our brains are designed to forget. Why is forgetting such an important part of our memory?
Well, I liken it to, imagine you're trying to design a vehicle, right? And so you could design a vehicle that's going to carry around a bunch of junk, right? In which case, you're not going to get good handling. You're not going to get good fuel economy. But on the other hand, you could design a car that's more for performance. And you could do it in a way that's like economical, but it can still stop on a dime and it's got very fast performance. And our brain's taken that approach as opposed to the haul around a bunch of junk approach. So on one hand, we tend to forget a lot of information. In fact, the majority of the details of our lives will be reduced to like a much smaller fraction of that within even a couple of days. But on the other hand, that information, we tend to be able to use it very effectively. So we make the most of what's there.
There are different kinds of memory, if I'm reading your book right. Information, remembering a particular date or fact or something is one kind of memory. Remembering our events in our lives can be a different kind of memory. How do those two things work differently?
Yeah, so there's that remembering, having the knowledge about things that happen, like being able to just know information about, say, what you do with a cell phone or something like that. That's actually, maybe that's not the best example. Being able to know information about, let's say, British history or something if you studied it in school. On the other hand, there's your memory for a trip to Britain that you might have taken. And so that would be associated not with any particular general information, but it would be more this experience of being able to travel back to a time and place in your mind. In fact, Endel Tulving called episodic memory as a kind of mental time travel. And so this kind of memory is different because it's specific to a particular time and place. Whereas semantic memory is some knowledge that we can use anywhere, anytime, in any place.
Charan Ranganath is with us. His new book is called Why We Remember, Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters. You can join in. If you have a question about memory, a story about memory to share, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Charan, you're a memory researcher. You're also a musician and a music fan. Reading your book and your chapter titles put like 80 different songs in my head over the last couple of days. There's something uniquely powerful, it seems like, when it comes to music and how it can trigger, enhance, provoke memories. What is it about music?
Well, I think there's so many factors, but I'll just give you a few. So one is that music evokes emotions. And so as a result, you know, these emotional experiences are the ones that we tend to prioritize in memory. So that alone gives us an advantage. But we also have, we uniquely associate music with particular times in our life. So I don't know if you've had this, like, have you ever had a time where, like a summer or something, where you just listen to a song and then you stopped listening to it after that? Have you experienced something like that?
Oh, so much. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's like you have this song that you just listened to for that period. And so now that song is like the soundtrack to that time in your life. And when you hear it, it can evoke some kind of sense of what it was like to be at that place in time. And once you're mentally back in that place in time, you now have access to all of these memories that you might not have been able to see before. And so that's one of the reasons why music is so evocative. Another is that we tend to remember certain times in our life, which are the times where our sense of who we are is being formed. So like times from adolescence all the way up to, let's say, adulthood. And so that period of time is also when our musical tastes tend to really become quite focused. So I think that's another thing as well, is that we like to look back on those parts of our life.
Now, I started the conversation mentioning something I think has happened to a lot of people. Here's my keys. Just set them down on the counter here. Now, sometimes I'm like a lot of people. I might set them down somewhere in my house and then forget where I set them and then go nuts trying to find them when I need to leave the house again. There's a lot of complicated stuff going on, and there are ways to help us do better. Talk us through that finding our keys scenario.
Well, so the problem with finding your keys and the reason it's so hard is that you have so many competing memories of places that you've kept your keys, right? So unless you have a habit of putting your keys in the same place, and I certainly don't. So what happens is that every time I'm looking for my keys, I'm just stuck with all of these different competing memories for it. And it's not a very unique memory. Adding to that is the problem that we're often distracted, either because we're in our own heads, which is me most of the time, to be honest, or because we're getting distracted by alerts on our phones or, you know, other devices, for instance. And then there's, of course, the things that you can't avoid, like, for instance, any parent of a newborn child, they're crying, you have to drop everything and go take care of that. So there's lots of these distractions that move us away from actually being able to focus on what we're doing in the moment. As far as how to go back and find those keys later, the best advice I can give you is to try to mentally retrace your steps. And I know it's kind of a cliche, but it really is true. If you can bring yourself in your mind, not to the point where you put down your keys, but the points leading up to it. Like, just imagine what happened when I opened the door and what was I thinking about at the time. Sometimes that can ignite the memory because you're now activating that context in your head.
And related to that, and correct me if I'm not reading you right, what we sometimes think of memory decline, say over time, I'm getting worse at remembering where I put my keys. It's not necessarily that, you know, I'm losing that ability to, put that data into my brain. It's that I'm losing my ability to filter out some of those distractions you were talking about. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So as we get older, what happens is that there's an area of the brain called the prefrontal cortex, and it's really important for allowing us to use memory to get what we need when we need it. And so the prefrontal cortex's function tends to go down as we get older. And so as a result, we struggle a little bit more to find the right information when we need it. Sometimes we get the wrong information, and we're a little bit slow to pick up the mistakes when that happens.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Fidel is with us in Milwaukee. Fidel, hi. What did you want to bring up?
Hi there. Yes, I wanted to bring up a video on YouTube I saw regarding chimpanzees. I remember seeing this video. These chimpanzees were shown these numbers on the screen, and they were tapping. After a couple seconds, they were meant to tap what the numbers were showing. And I thought that was fascinating. You know, after a couple seconds, they could already remember what the numbers were. And so I don't know if maybe the speaker could maybe speak on, you know, differences between human memory and either our ancestors or how it's evolved over time.
Interesting, Fidel. And I know you've looked at sea lions and mice and I think other primates as well. How do their memories compare and contrast with ours?
Well, there's so much there. So, I mean, I first of all, just to expand on Fidel's question, there was an experiment that was done where they teach these chimpanzees math. And what they found was that they could actually be faster in some ways than people could. And part of the issue is that these chimpanzees were trained to do this task over and over and over again. And humans, if they're trained to become experts on any particular task, are amazing at it. So if you look at an expert chess player, they can just look at a chessboard and immediately commit that information to memory. So expertise buys you an awful lot. I think what makes human memory so effective is that we can grab pieces of information that don't correspond to what we knew, that don't correspond to anything we've ever experienced before. And that's what makes humans especially effective. That kind of episodic memory, I can't say that it doesn't happen in other animals. There are birds, for instance, that can actually show this exceptional ability to remember where and when something happened. Really cool study of birds where a bird is being watched by another bird while they bury their food for the winter. And then as soon as the other bird goes away, they return back to that spot, dig it up, and put it somewhere else because they remembered that this happened and they were being watched. And so they needed to move it so the other bird wouldn't steal their food. So there's a lot we don't know about how rich animals' memories are. You mentioned the sea lions, and that was just a fun study to be part of, where what we found was that sea lions are exceptional foragers, and so they have great memory for where they get their food from. But if you look at sea lions that have eaten, for instance, toxic algae in these red tides, or they eat fish that eat these algae, they can get damaged to parts of the brain that actually affect memory. And so these are often the animals that wash up on the shore. They're washing up to the shore because they've lost that ability to remember where they are. And so to some extent, they resemble what happens to people in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, where they're sort of floating in space and time.
Charan Ranganath is with us from University of California, Davis. He researches memory there. His new book is called Why We Remember, Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters. You could join in at 800-642-1234. I'm going to put my keys back in my pocket before I forget where I put them. How about you? Do you have little tips to help you remember where you put your keys, the name that goes along with that face? What is the earliest memory you have? Have you ever remembered an event differently from someone else who experienced it with you? Do you have questions about how memory works? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Charan Ranganath, professor of psychology, director of neuroscience at the University of California at Davis, talking about his new book, Why We Remember, Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about memory and how it works? A story to share about a time when you maybe doubted your memory for one reason or another? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Brian is with us in Duluth. Brian, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what'd you want to tell us about, Brian?
Yeah, right. I tell you what, I had prostate cancer a little over a year ago diagnosed, and then chemotherapy, radiation to the spine, which is CNS, central nervous system. And then I'm on androgen deprivation therapy indefinitely. And my understanding is that chemotherapy, all of those three things, spine is the central nervous system as well, can cause memory issues. Doesn't necessarily, but it does. It can. And it did in me. Mm-hmm. And so what seems to have happened is that I have kind of plateaued an improvement there, and I think that's because the androgen deprivation therapy is kind of a ceiling on my memory.
Interesting. Brian, thanks for the call. Now, Sharon, of course, you can't give specific medical advice for Brian, but is this common? Cancer treatments, hormone treatments, things like that, having an impact on our memory?
Yes, definitely. There's something that your caller talked about that reminded me of work on chemo brain, which is basically during chemotherapy, people have a lot of trouble remembering. Some of it is related to the prefrontal cortex that we talked about before. And so, again, this idea that you have trouble being able to focus on what's relevant at the time. And so that gives you the sense of being in a mental fog. I mean, in general, one of the things we're finding is that things that affect the immune system, well, the immune system acts in the brain. And so those inflammatory conditions like long COVID can also affect memory. And I'm sure some of your listeners who are struggling with that, you know, it's a very real thing that these conditions can affect memory. The good thing is that there's some evidence suggests that this can be reversible. And in fact, your caller might be reassured to find that one of the world's memory champions is a memory athlete named Scott Hagwood. He got into memory competitions because he was doing chemotherapy, and he started to learn all these memory skills from a book that he had read. So it's definitely possible to work better with what you have.
Thanks a lot for that call. Good luck to you, Brian. And I want to leap on that phrase there, memory athlete. Until I read your book, I didn't know there were competitive memory events.
Yeah, there's a famous one who I mentioned in the book named Yenya Wintersoul. And she actually memorized an entire IKEA catalog. And so these are the kinds of things that they ask these memory athletes to do, is just these incredible feats of remembering arbitrary, like you might give them an entire deck of cards and give them like a certain amount of time to just be able to form memories for the entire thing. And they're just incredible at this stuff. And the reason is not because they were born with some perfect photographic memory, but they just learn skills just like any other athlete does.
Thanks for the call, Brian. We're talking to Charan Ranganath about his new book, Why We Remember, Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters. Another Brian on the line now, Brian in Madison. Brian, hi, what did you want to bring up?
Hi, so I just had a quick question about how trauma impacts memories. I was a freelance writer during the protests in 2020, some of which became riots, and noticed I have very specific and detailed moments of individual parts of those days and evenings, and the rest of it almost immediately was not remembered at all. So just kind of a question about what is the physical process that's happening there, and then also what's the utility for our memory working that way in traumatic circumstances?
Brian, thanks for the call. Charan, you've worked with people dealing with trauma, Vietnam veterans, and others. How does trauma affect our memory?
Oh, it's such a beautiful question. So one of the things that we know about memory is that during these emotionally intense experiences, like stressful experiences, as your caller described, you can get a release of both stress hormones, and sometimes you can get a fight or flight response, which is associated with a chemical called noradrenaline. And they promote plasticity in the brain, so they allow these normally transient memories to stick. But we don't necessarily remember everything from those experiences. We tend to focus on the things that were most emotionally relevant, right? So your caller might have remembered, you know, being afraid for their life at some scary moment during these protests, but not necessarily remember which shoes he was wearing at the time. And that's because it's not so relevant to the emotional part. And your caller said it beautifully that why is this? And I think the thing is that our brain is designed to prioritize our limited memories for the things that are most important. And from a biological perspective, things that give us stress, things that give us anxiety or fear are going to be the most important experiences, because if I, you know, find a snake, or if I find a saber-toothed tiger, what, you know, caveman ancestors, I should say, it's important to know that not only that I saw those things, but I also want to know where they were so I can avoid them in the future. And so that's why I think it made sense that traumatic memories will stick around. But obviously, it can be very difficult to have these recurring traumatic memories that come back at inopportune times.
Brian, thanks for that call. I want to spend our last couple minutes with some memory hygiene. Charan, what are some good daily healthy behaviors we can do that are going to help us remember stuff better?
Well, there's the long-term things, like anything that affects your body health will affect your brain health, which will affect your memory. So a lot of the things that we think of as being good, especially for aging, exercise, a healthy diet, and so forth, are going to be things that can help you age better with memory. Even things like we're just finding out things like people have hearing problems, using hearing aids can help preserve memory function, or things like even gum disease can potentially affect memory function. We're still learning a lot. But in terms of the everyday memory hygiene for anyone, the things I think that I would suggest more than anything else is to like remove your distractions and do not multitask. And what I mean by that is we're often doing something, but then interrupted. For instance, we get it in our own heads, or we're interrupted because, you know, there's an incident with family or something, like child is upset, you need to drop everything and talk to them. But then there's the things that we do to ourselves, like, you know, phone alerts, for instance, or if you have a watch that tells you every time you get a text message. These are the things that are everyday memory blockers, because once you start focusing on that email or that text message and you come back, what happens is that it actually takes your brain a little bit of extra processing just to get you back on track. And that has a cost in terms of both what you're doing in the moment, but also memory. And so often we think we're being very efficient by checking our text messages and then talking and then checking email and then talking. But in fact, what happens is we actually are losing memory for all these experiences. And so you're much better off taking your time to daydream, then taking your time to do email, and then taking your time to be in the moment in a conversation rather than flipping back and forth in between.
Charon, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Charon Ranganath is professor of psychology and director of the neuroscience lab at the University of California at Davis. And he joined us for a look at his new book, Why We Remember, Unlocking Memory's Power to Hold On to What Matters. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We have a lot of Scandinavian heritage here in Wisconsin. Maybe you've been to the Sitten to Mai Festival in Stoughton, visited the Trolls of Mount Horeb, or enjoyed traditional foods from the region at restaurants or homemade. Maybe your family eats Norwegian lefse around the holidays even. On this edition of Food Friday, a chef and restaurant owner brings us her experiences baking in Denmark for many years and shares some of her favorite Scandinavian baked goods from her new cookbook. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you traveled in Scandinavian countries? Do you have Scandinavian heritage in your own family? Do you have some favorite baked goods from that tradition? Do you make some of these Scandinavian staples like lefse from Norway, Swedish cinnamon buns, Danish kringle? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Nicole Acetola is chef and owner of Canteen, a Scandinavian-inspired restaurant in San Francisco. Her new cookbook is Scandinavian from Scratch, a love letter to the baking of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. Nicole, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, you've got a personal story of how you got hooked on Scandinavian baking. Share a little bit of that with us, please.
Yeah, you know, it's a story that spans many more years than I had initially thought it would. I started out by going, I had worked as a chef in Boston, trained chef from Culinary Institute of America, started working out in the field, upscale restaurants in Boston, and kind of got burnt out with the whole thing and thought, you know what, a lot of chefs go to Europe. Maybe I should try and train over there and just get a new perspective on things. And to be honest, I would have preferred to have gone to Italy or France, but I knew some people in Denmark. And so I decided to head that way and have crash on their couches and so forth, and fell in love with Scandinavia and that lifestyle there and didn't want to come back. And so I ended up staying. Eventually, I went back. I had went back and forth over a number of visits, and I ended up moving over there thinking I'm going to stay for 1 year and get some training and so forth. And I ended up staying for 15 years. So.
And you encountered something that I love the concept of. This is in Copenhagen, the pastry, mm-hmm. the pastry crawl. That sounds like my idea of a
yes.
good time. Tell us what goes on there.
Yeah. So, you know, Noma is has been a very, very famous restaurant. And there have been teams and armies of people working at Noma in both the pastry, but also the savory kitchen. And, you know, they've kind of gotten roots in Denmark. A lot of people stick around after they no longer worked at Roma anymore. And so, if, funny enough, it's really affected the way that you eat in casual restaurants and also bakeries. So there is there are more fantastic bakeries. That, like, they're so concentrated in Copenhagen than any other city I know. San Francisco is also a great baking city, by the way. But so when I have a friend, her name's Paula. And when I am now in Copenhagen, we always make time to go on a pastry crawl. And it's basically we get up early at the crack of dawn. We much rather do this than a bar crawl. You know, we wake up, we bike around. So we're, you know, getting some motion in there, some exercise in between our stops. But we basically go from place to place. And because we're two, we can share some things and not get too full too fast. But we basically go to the top bakeries in the city and, yeah, sample the best that they have.
All right, now you've got some savory and some sweet stuff. Let's start with sweet and the pastries. And let's key in on one vital spice here, the cardamom. Why is this such an important part of our Scandinavian treats?
Yeah, you know, cardamom is magical when it comes to spices. Cardamom is in many other world cuisines, but in particular Sweden, they consume a great amount of cardamom in that country, much more than Norway or Denmark. And, you know, I think when it's done right, when you buy the right ingredients, and by that I mean when you grind fresh cardamom, it is so beautiful. It's kind of citrusy and almost like, it just has, it's not like anything you would ever recognize from the pre-ground variety that you buy in the grocery store.
Yeah, and you have this like middle ground cardamom you talk about. You can buy powdered, don't get that, you say. You can get the whole pod, and that's kind of difficult. What are you recommending we try to find?
Yeah, so you should go for something that is available online if you want. If you are an avid fan of cardamom, I would say go for what's called decorticated cardamom. And it's basically, if you were to take those cardamom pods and smash them lightly or crush them, you could pull out these little black seeds. And those black seeds are what decorticated cardamom is. It's the most flavorful part of the cardamom. And when you grind them fresh right before you're ready to eat it or to put it in your baked good, it is just so much more fragrant and almost eucalyptus and so many more flavor notes and much more complex than what you would get, which is the pre-ground. Who knows when that was ground and put into a jar, right?
It is Food Friday. We're talking to Nicole Isatola about her new cookbook. It's called Scandinavian from Scratch, A Love Letter to the Baking of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Okay, Nicole, you've shared a few recipes with us. I want to check out one that highlights another key ingredient, almonds here. This is semlor, and I guess that's plural.
Yes.
If you have just one, it's a semla. If I have lots, and I'll have lots, it's semlor. Tell us a little bit about this dish.
Yeah, so essentially this is a light, fluffy bun that's eaten around Lent time or before Lent starts technically, so you can fatten up before the fast begins. So it has these religious notes or roots, but it's not always associated with that. It's just something that you eat around this time of year. And it's tremendously popular in the Swedish community, but we've adopted it in Denmark as well. I think all the best bakeries are all making it right around, you know, January, February. Some bakeries in Sweden, up in Stockholm, they do it year round because it is so popular. But it's a light, fluffy bun that's scented with cardamom. And when it's been baked, you hollow it out almost like a twice baked potato, and you save those innards and you mix it together with almond paste and a little bit of milk. And then you put it back inside And then you put a nice dollop or a piping of whipped cream on top and put the top back on like a jack-o'-lantern kind of thing. It is so decadent and luxurious. Yeah, I would also always be referring to it in the plural form.
And I'm looking at the pictures of the semlor right now. They look awesome. And also, you mentioned the almond paste. And this is a frequent flyer, mm-hmm. right, in the pastries we're talking about.
It sure is, yeah. A lot of times as fillings in different pastries, we have a favorite pastry in Denmark that is very traditional that we also have a recipe for in the book. It's called tebirkes, and it's basically a croissant dough, so very flaky as opposed to the soft fluffy of the semla, but it's a flaky pastry dough with an almond paste center. It's so good.
All right, now let's get savory a little bit here. Mm-hmm. Rye bread, Danish rye mm-hmm. bread. You are a huge fan of this stuff. Now, I like mm-hmm. rye bread. Talk a little bit about what makes Danish rye bread this distinct and awesome thing.
Yeah, so most people, when they think about rye bread, unless they've grown up in Europe or have a reference to Europe with the dark rye breads type, a lot of people think that it's similar to a Jewish rye, which it is not. It's a completely different animal of its own. And it is it's usually darkened with malt, with the addition of malt, and it's the one that I make is a sprouted rye bread. So it's a little bit easier on your stomach, a little bit more nutritious. It's not like the old traditional rye bread that you eat in Denmark or you ate in Denmark was kind of like sat heavy in your stomach and was mainly based only on rye flour. This is a lighter version of a modern twist on it where you have these sprouted rye berries in there, the actual rye grains that are sprouted. And then we've got lots of seeds in there. So it's a dark rye type, but it's not heavy in that way. And it's excellent for slicing thinly and then topping with all kinds of toppings, which we call, it's our open face sandwiches that we call smørrebrød.
I was gonna bring that up next, whether we're making our own rye bread or buying it. Mm-hmm. Like Denmark, I think, is famous for these open-faced sandwiches. I'm just trying to smørrebrød. Am I pretty close there?
Yes, okay. Yeah, very good.
And you gave us a recipe for one that mm-hmm. looks good to me. Others mm-hmm. in my family, I don't think are going to want to touch it because it has beets and herring, but it is a Russian herring salad with beets mm-hmm. and apple smørrebrød. We've got it up mm-hmm. With that couple other things at WPR.org/food. Tell us about this combo on this Danish open-faced sandwich.
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny, you know, we are in Denmark, Scandinavia, Norway. It is a Northern European influence by a lot of many of the same things that are the foods and ingredients that you'll find in Eastern Europe, in Finland and so forth. So there is and also some Russian influences as well. And so this is for sure something that's been influenced from Russia, that where there's a beet and apple salad that's mayonnaise. There's some mayonnaise. There's some crunchy. There's some pickle slices in there. There's capers, some sour cream, and so it's a nice creamy dressing that you put on top of a nice slice of this of the rye bread. And you can put the herring in there as we did in the book, but in case your relatives maybe wouldn't go for it, you can also put in some potatoes, some boiled potatoes, dice them up, and just leave out the herring. It's delicious.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Caro is with us in Madison. Caro, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
Hi, Caro.
Hi. Well, I just want to say I grew up in northern Michigan with my Scandinavian ancestors. I grew up in a Swedish church, and just all the great food that we made there, especially the bakers, the women that would bake Swedish coffee bread. My grandmother used to make this Swedish limpa bread. Mm-hmm. When it would be hot out of the oven, we'd smear butter on it, and it was so good.
And it's a slightly sweet bread, correct?
Yes, it's like mm-hmm. a sweet rye bread. Mm-hmm. And one of our Christmas traditions to this day is having Swedish potato sausage on Christmas Eve.
Caro, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Now, let's talk about what would make a Swedish or any of the countries you're talking about a coffee cake distinctively Scandinavian.
Well, you know, I mean, so we make something that's similar to a coffee cake here, and we have as our default spice cardamom because it lends itself so well to fruits and so forth. the Scandinavian countries are also big on dairy, so there's got to be lots of good butter. We have also some sour cream or yogurt in there. You know, just like some richness where it's not so much about the size of the chunk that you're going to be eating because it will be rich, but it is full of flavor and moist.
Thanks again for that call. We are talking to Nicole Isatola, chef and owner of Canteen, a Scandinavian-inspired restaurant in San Francisco. It's Food Friday. We're talking about her new cookbook. It's called Scandinavian from Scratch, a love letter to the baking of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite sweet treat from Scandinavia? Do you love the Danish rye bread? We talking about your family, maybe something you grew up with here. Is there something you still like to make yourself? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Chef Nicole Isatola about her new book, Scandinavian from Scratch, which offers recipes and techniques for delicious baked goods, many sweets, some savory from Denmark, Sweden, and Norway. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What foods and flavors make you think of those Scandinavian countries? Do you have a favorite baked good from Norway, Sweden, or Denmark? Did you grow up with these baked goods? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can find a few recipes that Nicole shared with us at WPR.org/food. Let's go back to your calls now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi, how are you doing? I'm so glad to have this show because this is a question right on my mind these days. I'm 70% Scandinavian, Danish, and but mostly Swedish. And besides lingonberries and herring and sour cream, which even as a four-year-old, I was insane about. And actually, a very good thing with it is sautéed apples and onions. But is there something I could make as like a holiday thing for myself, like the summer solstice or something?
Kay, thanks a lot for the call. Nicole, can you help Kay embrace her culinary roots a little more? Nicole, are you there? Not hearing.
Sorry.
Oh, there
sorry.
You are. Great. Okay.
Sorry, but yeah, was that for the summer solstice or the winter solstice?
She mentioned summer, so how about a nice light summer something for Kay? Yeah.
Yeah, so in along the sweet notes, I would say we have a wonderful cake. It's actually, when people ask me what's your favorite recipe out of the book, it's called the Royal Party Cake, and it's great because it's extremely versatile. It's basically a cake that two thin layers. You take a cake batter, you spread it into two small cake pans. On top of that, before it's baked, you put on meringue. You bake both pans at the same time. And when you take that out, you can layer it up with some whipped cream on each layer, then put the one layer on top of the other and with some fresh fruit like piled in between there. So it's really beautiful when summer is at its peak and you have all kinds of fresh berries, especially, as was mentioned, red lingonberries, fresh red currants, you know, strawberries, raspberries, anything. It's amazing. In the summertime, it's a no-brainer. In the wintertime, you can mix it up with some stewed fruit or something like that. But
okay, thanks a lot for the call. Hope that helps. We'll go to Gary now in Johnson Creek. Gary, hi.
Hi. Years ago, I had a lefse that was made with cottage cheese. And I wonder if you have ever heard of a recipe containing cottage cheese.
No, that's a new one for me, Gary. We have potato-based ones and flour-based ones, but no, I've never heard of cottage cheese. I'm going to have to check that out.
Thanks a lot for the call, Gary. I hadn't heard of that either. That reminds me, we don't have this up, but one thing that struck me, you got some pancakes there with rye. Okay, that sounds pretty cool. And a secret ingredient of beer in our pancakes.
Yeah.
How'd that beer get in there?
Well, it probably was an accident, maybe sometime in the kitchen, but it works out, you know, they say that, you know, a meal can be very satisfying if it meets, you know, all the different senses and the taste, you know, with sweet and salty and bitter and umami and so forth. And that sourness that comes from the beer matches so well with the sweetness that you're bound to put on it, whether it be berries or some sugar, cinnamon sugar, or cardamom sugar and so forth. So it's really good. More than what you might assume.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jan is with us now in Milwaukee. Jan, hi.
Hi, I'm Danish. My father grew up in Denmark. My grandmother was more Norwegian, but Lefse was always a big thing, and I just started listening. I'm sure Lefse has probably been mentioned. But another thing my grandma made, which is probably very unhealthy, I think she called them rosettes.
And I
think it was pretty much what we call funnel cakes over here, deep fried.
Yeah, the fried ones. Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead, Jan.
To this day, my aunt still gets together with her daughter, my cousin, and they kind of make a party of it. She runs the show because she knows how to make the lefse.
Thanks.
Every year they have a lefse party.
Love it. Thanks so much for sharing that, Jan. Now, that reminds me, you wrote in the book, Nicole, that part of why you wanted to start a restaurant in San Francisco was there were people like you and other people familiar with Scandinavian food, and it was a Scandinavian bakery desert in San Francisco. Talk about that a little.
Yeah, it really was. There was nobody else doing Scandinavia. You would think that, you know, a lot of attention had come to Scandinavia for Noma and so forth, but that's on an upscale level. And I just kind of missed those staples that I was used to having while living in Scandinavia. So I figured, you know, hey, you know, I started baking rye bread one loaf at a time and kind of perfecting my own recipe for at home, and then saw that there was a need among Scandinavians and also some people, you know, that some Germans and so forth of large population. You know, a lot of Scandinavians moved to San Francisco, among other places like Wisconsin. And so, you know, we're meeting a need here.
Thanks again for that call. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Nicole Acetola, chef and owner of the restaurant Canteen in San Francisco. Her new cookbook is called Scandinavian from Scratch, a love letter to the baking of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. I love waffles. You've got some Scandinavian waffles. They're different than, say, your Belgian-type waffle. There's some special gear that we could get to make them just right. Tell us a little bit about the waffles you work with.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, there's a lot of people are familiar with Belgian waffles, and those are usually quite thick, and they have deep crevices for topping and putting whipped cream and so forth on. These Scandinavian waffles are different. They are usually very, very thin, and traditionally, most people have a waffle iron at home, whether it be electric or something for the range, but it's usually in the pattern of some hearts that are joined. The bases of the hearts are joined to create a kind of star of hearts. In this particular recipe, I use kefir, which is like a yogurt-based drink or ingredient. It gives a nice little sourness to the dough, similar to the sourness that comes from the beer in the pancakes. And then you can top it with either savory or sweet. As you like, I like to have it sweet, but you can definitely put, you know, a piece of smoked fish on there or something like that. Then I would probably omit the cardamom that's in this recipe as well. But just a good smear of some good jam and a little bit of whipped cream or powdered sugar is really, really delicious. I buy my iron, my waffle iron online. And yeah, it works out really well. They're nice and crispy. Mm-hmm.
And Nicole, my brother lives in San Francisco. He hasn't been to your restaurant yet. He may swing by after work today.
Send him over.
Yeah, if there was one pastry that's like, this is the one you got to try. This is like the A1, number one thing that people are going to love here. What should he or whoever try picking up?
One pastry.
Just
okay.
One.
Well,
he can only
I
eat
would
so much.
Say, yeah. So I would say probably, I know some just came out of the oven. Now we're going to be closing here shortly. So he better rush over
it.
Here. Yeah, we have some cardamom morning buns. Again, that same flaky Danish dough that is very, is just king in Scandinavian bakeries. It's similar to the croissant dough, nice and flaky. We smear it with some of those, that freshly ground decorticated cardamom seeds and some butter, and roll it up like a cinnamon knot. You would do an American cinnamon bun. And then we slice it and put it in a muffin pan and let it puff up and then into the oven with it. And so it has a caramelized base, but then nice and airy and fluffy on the inside. It is to die for.
Nicole, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob. It's been so much fun.
That's Nicole Acetola, chef and owner of Canteen, a Scandinavian-inspired restaurant in San Francisco. She was with us on Food Friday to share recipes from her new cookbook. It's called Scandinavian from Scratch, a love letter to the baking of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. You can find a few recipes that Nicole shared with us at WPR.org/food. That's WPR.org/food. A pastry, a coconut cake that we didn't even really talk about, and then an open-faced rye bread sandwich. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. If you're online or using an app, chances are there's an algorithm recommending what you read, watch, or listen to next. With the rise of social media and platforms like YouTube, Netflix, and Spotify, algorithms have come to shape our experience online in a profound way, and our next guest says it's shaping our lives offline, too. You could join in at 800-642-1234. When you're on social media or a streaming service, do you find that you're getting good stuff recommended to you, stuff that you want to see? Or is it just more and more of the same thing you liked already? Do you keep watching that sort of stuff? Do you wish you could break out of that somehow? Join in at 800-642-1234. And if you find cool stuff in other ways, from friends or a critic or something, where do you go for those independent suggestions of what to watch or read? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kyle Chayka is a staff writer for The New Yorker covering technology and culture on the internet. His new book is called Filter World, How Algorithms Flattened Culture. Kyle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start big picture before we start prying open these algorithms. What is it like living in filter world? What do you mean by that concept?
Yeah, I mean, as you introduced in the show, we're now surrounded by all of these algorithmic recommendations. And these are digital platforms that are pushing content at us, constantly telling us what we should be watching or what we might be interested in, the next song on Spotify, the next video on TikTok, a show to watch on Netflix. And I just wanted to come up with a word to describe how we're being bombarded by these recommendations all the time.
And with algorithms, whether they're used in culture, which is what you're focusing on, or whatever, there's a sense, I think, oh, it's like math and science, so we're getting the right answer to this. A big key point of your book is they were created in every instance with a human intention, with an outcome that the creators are hoping for. Lift the veil behind the algorithms that shape our cultural lives.
Absolutely. I think we often forget that the algorithms we interact with online are decisions made by tech companies. So it's not just an equation that perfectly measures your interests and your tastes and gives you what you're going to be interested in. But instead, it's this equation that helps the tech company make more profit. So in the case of Spotify, it's that you keep listening to songs. On Facebook, it's that you're engaging with the articles that are in your feed and you're constantly looking for more. So I think it really helps to keep in mind what incentives we're looking at here.
And you have this idea of algorithms flattening our culture. What do you mean by flattening?
I think there's this overall homogenization going on. And I think it's happening because all of these equations are essentially programmed to give us more of what we're already interested in. So Spotify will give you more songs that are kind of like the songs you already like. X or Twitter will give you more tweets that kind of follow what you've shown that you're interested in. And I think over time, it's kind of like a funnel where all the users on a platform are being funneled into these buckets of content that follow certain themes that they've expressed interest in. And I think it's hard to break out of this system. It's hard to say to the algorithm, I don't want more of the same thing. Like, I want to get some different perspectives or get a different kind of content.
Now, of course, when you say algorithm and all this, I think of online stuff. But one of your starting points, actually, in an article you wrote years ago, was in the real world. And it was that cool local coffee shop looks the same as that cool local coffee shop in another state, another country, another continent. Could you talk us through how that flattened out, in part based on algorithms?
Right. I mean, I noticed this phenomenon, I think, starting around 2015, 2016, that all these quote unquote local coffee shops, wherever I went, tended to look the same. And this was, you know, no matter if I'm in the United States or in China or Germany or anywhere else, the coffee shop had this look that was like white subway tiles on the walls, lumpy ceramic mugs with, you know, latte art in them, brightly colored blobby posters on the walls. And I think that generic quality, it wasn't because a parent company was telling coffee shop owners to decorate their places the same way, like a Starbucks. It was because suddenly in the 2010s, we all got sucked into these massive digital platforms and we all started following each other and chasing the same trends and looking at the same aesthetics. And that creates an overall flattening over time because we're all just kind of following the same ideas and following the same algorithmic currents. So our tastes harmonize, as one person told me.
Kyle Chayka is with us. We're talking about his new book. It's called Filter World, How Algorithms Flattened Culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kyle, most of us are using social media platforms, things like that, as consumers, but you also look at how this affects creators. And if there's an algorithm that says, hey, this is the kind of thing I'm going to put in front of people, creators, if they want their stuff to be seen, are kind of chasing the algorithm, which is easier said than done. What did you find when you looked into that?
It's so true. I mean, I think as consumers, so much of our attention is mediated by these feeds. Like we're watching and listening to what the algorithms recommend to us. And so if you're an artist, like a musician or a painter or, you know, a choreographer, you have to think about what is going to work on these platforms. So you have to think about what looks good on Instagram, what kind of dance moves are going to play well on TikTok, what kind of music is going to be picked up as a viral TikTok sound. And those are kind of the commercial demands of our time, I think. I mean, even as an author, publishers would ask me, how many followers do you have on Twitter? You know, how many people are already in your audience online? So I think our presences online as creators and the trends going on these platforms really shape how we make our art.
And not just art, but also media. I think we're going to have a training in the works on the dreaded SEO, search engine optimization, here at Wisconsin Public Radio. You talked about at one point in your life somehow, and I didn't quite get how this worked, working what looked like wedding announcements into some of your work to try to get picked up and get SEO optimized. This also shapes how we try to deliver news to people.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that particular anecdote was from Facebook in like the early 2010s. And people had figured out that if you pretended to announce a wedding or an engagement, you would get boosted by the algorithm, because obviously the algorithm registers this wedding or engagement idea and is like, okay, tons of people are going to want to see this. And rather than actually announcing a wedding, you would be like, here's my wedding announcement. Yay, congratulate me. But here's actually my new news story that I just wrote. And so it would be a hack in a way. You were trying to hack the algorithm. But it was so hard to tell what would actually work and what wouldn't. I think over time, we all develop these superstitions about algorithmic recommendations.
And that points to a big point in your book is, and other people noted this, a lack of transparency in algorithms, whether they stay the same for years or Facebook makes a big change or whatever. We, the consumers at least, don't know what is driving what's being shown to us. How big a problem do you see that?
Oh, it's such a big problem. I mean, there's so much opacity. I mean, people literally describe algorithms as black boxes. We're interacting with these digital platforms, whether it's Facebook or Instagram or TikTok, or even a news app like Apple News. And we literally can't tell how they're working. We can't tell how they're recommending us stories or pieces of content. And we can't tell when they change. And they change a lot. These algorithmic recommendations and the equations that drive them are always changing. The variables are always a little different. And when they do change, we sense that there's this huge difference in the system without necessarily being told. Like in recent years, Instagram really changed from promoting still images like photos to promoting videos. And no one said that out loud. But if suddenly if you posted a video, you'd get tons of promotion. And obviously, if you want to get that attention, if you want to promote your work or your life update, you're going to post that video. So it really shapes and dictates almost what you're putting out there.
it's a black box to us as consumers, but as we started off, it's not such a black box to the people creating it. They know what their goal is and what they're trying to nudge us toward. More and more, that seems to stuff that's going to serve their advertisers.
Absolutely. So, I mean, how most digital platforms work is that they sell advertising. So you are not paying Facebook money. Instead, Facebook is surveilling what you look at, what stories you click on, what you buy, and then selling that data to advertisers who want to get your attention as well. So I think it also helps to remember the sole purpose, like the ultimate goal of all of these systems, is to sell more advertising. It's not to give you a better experience or deliver the thing that you're going to be most inspired by. It's literally to just track you better and sell you more ads.
Kyle Chayka is with us, staff writer at The New Yorker, covering technology and culture on the internet. We're talking about his new book, Filter World, How Algorithms Flatten Culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share your streaming, TV streaming experience or music streaming, say, or YouTube watching or whatever, is there a platform that you think gives you the content that you want pretty reliably, or do you find it unsatisfying? Does it seem to be to you like it's trying to get more money out of you over time? Or if you have ways of finding cool stuff, whether it's music or TV or movies, whatever, where do you go for it? Who is your source if it's not an online algorithm? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Kyle Chayka, author of the new book, Filter World, How Algorithms Flattened Culture. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever taken time off of technology to avoid algorithms? Do you think platforms like Facebook or search engines like Google are doing a good job of connecting you with content you wanted to find and that you enjoy? Or do you think the recommendations are getting worse? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller now. Nick is with us in Beloit. Nick, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
I'm doing all right. I find that like a lot of things I like are on specific channels or the people in the stores themselves. So like book reviews, I find, I always talk to this one guy at Barnes Noble who works there. He always just knows everything. But if I have a channel online, I want to say the KEXP channel on YouTube or like the NPR Tiny Desk Concerts, they all seem to just pick the right things.
Interesting, Nick. Thanks a lot. And Kyle, Nick is finding things that a person at the store or the record store or something like NPR's Tiny Desk Concert. You write about this in the book, where to look for inspiration and new stuff that isn't driven by an algorithm.
Yeah, I love this because it just speaks to how the original recommendation engine was another person, ideally an expert in whatever you're looking for. So it's great to go to the bookstore and ask a clerk at the store for a recommendation because they're going to know, you know, what the new books are, what you might be interested in. And that's a more human relationship and interaction than going on the Amazon homepage. Or connecting with a really cool cultural institution like KEXP, which is a radio station that produces really cool concert videos and puts them on YouTube. So I think, I mean, it's a good point also that you don't have to get offline to avoid algorithms. Like you can seek out really cool human curators, as I call them in the book, and people with really great taste and just consume what they post online as well.
Thanks a lot for that call, Nick, at 800-642-1234. That trip to the bookstore, Kyle, reminds me, you took kind of a surreal bookstore visit at an Amazon brick-and-mortar bookstore. Describe that for me. I've never been to one of these. It sounds weird.
It was very weird, and I have to preface this with, I think Amazon has now closed all of their bookstores because they were so unpleasant. But it was, you walked into the bookstore and all of the books, for one thing, were facing outwards. So you could just see thousands of covers everywhere, which was very chaotic. And the books were all organized by their kind of data on the Amazon website. So the books were sorted by what ratings they got, how many people read them, you know, whether they got a lot of good comments on the review section. And it just struck me as so strange because this was essentially bringing the digital experience into reality. And it just underlined how unpleasant that is. Like, I don't care when I'm in a bookstore, I don't care how many other people have bought a book. I don't care what the star rating is. What I'm really engaged with is what's in that book. Like, or do the people in the store like it? Like, I personally look for those staff recommendation, you know, little pieces of paper underneath the books. Yeah, it just showed that the variables we measure on the internet for culture really don't stand up in the real world. And if we see them, you know, outside the physical world, it actually seems quite bizarre.
Talking to Kyle Chayka about his new book, Filter World, How Algorithms Flattened Culture. Kyle, I could see there being an argument like, okay, yeah, now it's algorithms. Back in the day, it was advertisers and marketing departments and network officials kind of figuring out a lowest common denominator where we could bring people in and flattening culture in a different way. Is that, do you think that's a fair comparison?
I think so. I mean, it's hard to say that one era is better or worse than another. I think in this era, algorithms have really taken over that role. And I think, you know, there are good and bad qualities to those kind of human gatekeepers too. So on the bad side, like the record label executive or the museum curator or the bookstore buyer, like they tend to ignore a lot of people. They might have their own blind spots in terms of like race or class, certainly. So there's flaws there for sure. But also what they are uniquely capable of doing is introducing a new voice into culture and just kind of picking something out based on their own taste and saying this thing is something that more people should see. And I think that had a way of highlighting more unusual or radical or interesting pieces of culture than what we're facing right now, which is essentially the tyranny of data. Like what we end up seeing the most is what is the most already popular. Like that Amazon store, like the metric is always what the most other people have clicked on is what you are going to be most likely to see or hear or watch.
Now, another element of the flattening of culture I'm reading in your book, Kyle, is the idea of good enough. So like the algorithm recommends something that's kind of like something else I liked, whether it's Netflix or YouTube or whatever. And that's fine. I'll go with that. I may not get that radically cool new thing, but I won't get that radically awful bad thing that doesn't fit with what I like. So we just kind of settle into this. And it isn't always fun. When I realize I'm there, I don't like it that much. You either.
I think there's an averageness to that. Like it's, I talk about the quality of being ambient in the book a lot. And this is a word that the musician Brian Eno came up with in the 70s. And it referred to stuff that was as ignorable as it is interesting. So you could easily ignore it and just like not really pay attention to it. And it would be pleasant enough. You could have it in the background. But then again, it wouldn't necessarily be so interesting. It wouldn't move you. It might not upset you. So I think we're kind of settling for that average quality. And what we're missing out on is the stuff that you might hate. Like it avoids you being too alienated or turned off by a piece of culture, but it's also lessening that kind of extremely moving, unique experience you have when you encounter a work of art that seems like just made for you and something that's just feels personal.
You did a personal experiment, Kyle. You tried to take some time and break free of algorithms. Talk about that experiment and what you learned.
This was an algorithm cleanse that I did, I think, in late 2022. And this was as I was finishing up writing the book. And I just felt totally overwhelmed by the internet. I'd been thinking about it so deeply for this book. And so basically, I cut myself off from all of these digital platforms that were driven by algorithms. I was not on social media. I wasn't listening to Spotify. I wasn't watching Netflix. And it really forced me to reset my relationship with the internet because so much of the internet is driven by algorithms. And it made me think a lot more about what I was consuming and be more intentional about what I was consuming. So I think overall it was a really healthy move, but the first few weeks were absolutely painful.
You're speaking in the past tense. I assume you've come back to that sort of thing, but do you find having done that you're more intentional about what you consume as opposed to Yeah, let her rip, see what plays next.
I think so. I mean, it did offer that kind of like reset. So I separated myself from the internet a little bit. I think I realized that my identity depended less on it and I didn't need it to inform quite so many of my decisions. So I was able to step back, and now I do think I'm a little more intentional, a little more aware of what I'm consuming, and just more aware of how things get to me. Like, when you don't have an algorithm delivering you stuff, when you don't have recommendations pushing stuff at you, you have to work harder yourself. You have to seek things out and kind of figure out what you're interested in.
One thing I've loved lately, Kyle, is I have a couple friends who are cooler than me, which is easy to do, who do things on Twitch or Mixcloud with audiences, you know, hovering around 10 people or so, where they share a bunch of music. Mm. Some of it I love, some of it I hate. I discover a lot of great new stuff. Do you think we need to do more of that, just sharing with friends in person, online, and curating for each other a little bit?
For sure. I would love more people to curate for each other. I think there's this misconception that like taste or being a curator is somehow a super elite activity that's only for insiders or, you know, tastemakers. But really anyone can do it. It's just about sharing what you like and sharing what makes you inspired or interested. So I love that example of just being on Twitch for 10 people. Like, on the internet, we're so often tempted to try for as big audience as possible, to try to like go viral or get more likes or whatever. And you really don't need to do that. Like, in the rest of history and in our normal lives, reaching 10 people was great. That's like a much more sustainable human interaction than going viral on TikTok or something.
That's a good place to leave it. Kyle, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, this was lovely. Thank you.
That's Kyle Chayka, staff writer at The New Yorker. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Filter World, How Algorithms Flattened Culture. You can still share your thoughts on where you go to discover cool new movies, music, TV shows, whatever. Let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org.